Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Geneva, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, Moving Forward Breast Cancer Survivorship. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer organizations. Many other organizations have collaborated with us to make the program possible today. And because of that collaboration, we have reached over 846 participants on the call today. So there's many of you on the call today. And you come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, and from rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And we are delighted with your response to our program today. And you're clearly a group of information seekers. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about our speakers, and there's an outline that they have prepared for our program today. There also is information about Cancer Care and all of our collaborating organizations. There's information about upcoming telephone and online support groups, as well as upcoming telephone education workshops. And, of course, there is an evaluation form. Most importantly, I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what you would like us to offer? The topics you'd like us to offer you in these programs is very important, your recommendations to us. We take them very seriously. Indeed, today's program and the topics that we're covering are topics that you've told us are very important to you for us to offer in these programs. So do take a moment. We're planning many programs coming up, and your suggestions, again, we would really like to take them. We take them quite seriously. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from AstraZeneca, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program and for a number of our programs on this topic. So I want to thank them for their support. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Linda Vidot. Dr. Vidot is the Medical Director, Breast Cancer Research Program, Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Dr. Vidot is also on the Executive Board of Cancer Care, and she also is a frequent presenter on our telephone education workshops, and I'm just delighted to have her with us today. And Dr. Vidot is going to cover a number of topics. She's going to talk about the current standard of care. She's going to talk about weight gain and other side effects and sticking with your treatment. So I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Vidot.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm so glad that all of you are taking the time in order to educate yourselves, because the more information you know, the better you're able to help yourselves and to help others. So to start off with, survivorship can mean different things to different people. For some, it can mean they were diagnosed with cancer. For others, it can mean that not only were they diagnosed with cancer, but they underwent treatment for cancer, survived it, and are now living their lives, albeit with that interruption. I'm not sure what definition this group would use, but I always think of a cancer survivor as someone who was diagnosed, underwent therapy, and is now moving on with their life. This last part, moving on with their life, is the key part of this scenario. Sometimes this can be harder than the actual diagnosis and treatment of cancer. Having taken care of breast cancer patients for a long time, my guess would be that the two greatest episodes of stress are right before someone starts treatment and then at the end of therapy. In theory, the end of therapy should be the beginning of survivorship, so why is this such a difficult time? I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that the cancer survivor has concerns that we, the medical team, up to this point, cannot adequately address with our current knowledge base. These include things such as, will my cancer come back? When will I get my energy back? When will my thinking processes return to normal? And in general, when will I return to normal? Easy questions to answer are things like, well, when's my hair going to start to grow back? And when are most of my chemotherapy-related side effects are going to get better? Those are the easy ones we deal with. So this is a good jumping-off point for you to have an in-depth discussion with your healthcare team, because it may help you put this in and of itself may help put you on the road to survivorship. I have found through the years that knowledge really is power, and the feeling of power you can acquire surrounding a cancer diagnosis empowers you to participate in your care. Similarly, this knowledge can help you move forward, and this has to be the same approach with survivorship issues moving forward. So today we're going to talk about a couple of topics. The first is, what is the standard care of a patient with breast cancer? What is the standard follow-up with a patient with breast cancer? And some of the specific topics, such as weight gain after treatment for breast cancer. So before I go any further, I want to outline in very general terms a typical breast cancer pathway to diagnosis and treatment. Along the way, we'll touch in a very general ways on some common therapies and some common side effects that play a role in survivorship issues. So breast cancer is usually picked up several ways, either through a breast exam or through an imaging study. An imaging study is a broad term used to describe how technology is used to find the abnormality in the breast. An example of this is a mammogram, a breast sonogram, or something called an MRI. When a suspicious area is identified, a piece of tissue needs to be obtained to look at it under a microscope. This is called a biopsy. There are different ways to obtain a biopsy, and some common ways that you might hear about are stereotactic needle biopsy, core biopsy, incisional biopsy, and excisional biopsy. A discussion with your doctor will help you understand what kind of biopsy is best for you. If this biopsy looks like breast cancer, then more often than not, another surgical procedure is needed and subsequently scheduled to remove the tumor with a wide rim of normal tissue around it. Sometimes tumor can be removed with a lumpectomy, which is just taking out the lump, and other times it is removed with a mastectomy, which is removal of the entire breast. The second thing that happens during the surgical procedure is that the lymph nodes under the arm are examined. Most of the time this is done by what is called a sentinel lymph node biopsy procedure. In that procedure, the area around the tumor is injected with blue dye and a radioactive substance. The lymphatic drainage channels of the breast absorb this dye and take it to the first draining lymph node of the breast. This is called the sentinel lymph node. The surgeon knows this is the sentinel lymph node because it is a bright blue lymph node, and when the Geiger counter is placed over the area of the lymph node, it is hot with radioactivity. After completion of surgery, the next decision is whether any additional therapy is needed to reduce the risk of tumor recurring anywhere in the body. You might wonder why, if all visible traces of the tumor are removed, is there a concern for cancer spreading elsewhere? That is because little bits and pieces of cancer cells can sometimes leave the tumor that's in the breast and travel in the circulation. Again, we don't exactly know when and if this will happen, but frequently we try to make estimations based on clinical trials done in the past of the likelihood of this happening. Other factors that are important in figuring out if additional treatment is needed include seeing what is the size of the tumor removed, whether any lymph nodes have cancer in them, and how the tumor grows. When I say how the tumor grows, I mean, does it use estrogen or progesterone, things we call hormones, to grow? Another question is, does it use another growth acceleration pathway called HER2-new to grow? All of these things help your medical team decide if more therapy is warranted to reduce the risk of tumor popping up somewhere else. And we give this a special name, and we call it adjuvant therapy. So I'm just mentioning all these terms because these are words that sort of recur and recur, and I want you to at least be familiar with them if you aren't already. When trying to help decide if more therapy is needed, there is a mental balancing act going on in the oncologist's head about the benefits of therapy, specifically the reduction of relapse of tumor coming back anywhere in the body versus the side effects, both short and long-term, of the treatment proposed. It is a good idea to ask your doctor why certain decisions are being made about treatment, and it is important to keep good lines of communication open with your healthcare team about this. As a patient, you have a right to actively participate in your treatment if that is the right approach for you. So for breast cancer, in the big picture, there are several potential therapies. One is hormone therapy, another chemotherapy, biologic therapy is the third one, and radiation therapy is also common. Sometimes only one type of therapy is recommended, sometimes all of them, and sometimes none. You will need to discuss this with your doctor as treatment is recommended for each individual situation. Radiation therapy is usually always recommended when a lymphectomy is performed. We know from clinical trials that if radiation is not included in the treatment plan, then there is a pretty high chance of breast cancer coming back right in the breast. Hormonal therapy or anti-hormonal therapy is recommended whenever a tumor is identified as using estrogen or progesterone to grow. There are many hormonal therapies on the market. They are all good, and there is a lot of discussion about which one is best and how to sequence them. Example of these medications are tamoxifen anastrozole, which is known as Arimidex, letrozole, which is known as Femara, exemestane, which is known as Aromacin. Biologic therapy, or Herceptin, is recommended when a tumor is demonstrated to use the HER2 new pathway to grow. We are currently studying how much is needed. Chemotherapy is much more varied, and you and your healthcare provider can discuss specifics. Common regimens include regimens such as ACT, TAC, CMS, CAF, AT, AC. All of these letters in these regimens stand for drug names, and because they are so long, we use acronyms to cut down on all the tongue-twisting name. The goal is to pick a regimen that has an established track record and a well-delineated toxicity profile. The goal is not to kill a flea with an elephant gun, or alternatively try to kill an elephant with a fly swatter. The treatments that have the most potential long-term side effects are the hormonal therapies and chemotherapy. Common short-term effects of chemo can be nausea, vomiting, and hair loss. These almost always resolve when chemotherapy is stopped. Potential longer effects can be seen with peripheral neuropathy, that is, tingling and numbness in the fingers and toes. This side effect fully resolves in most people who develop it from the taxanes group of chemotherapy drugs. Examples of drugs in this family include Taxol and Taxotere. Those who seem to have lingering peripheral neuropathy long after stopping chemotherapy are those who are diabetics. Again, it is important to keep open lines of communication with your healthcare team about these side effects so that long-term neuropathy can be minimized. There are no quick fixes to neuropathy, but there are some drugs that can lessen the signs and symptoms so that perhaps it is less bothersome. Another long-term side effect of chemotherapy can be the sudden induction of menopause or the stopping of ovarian function and production of estrogen if someone was premenopausal at the outset of chemotherapy. For some reason, women over 40 have a much higher risk of going into menopause as compared to their less than 40-year-old colleagues. Menopause can be a problem from a symptom management point of view, or it can be easy. It's hard to predict. The most problematic aspect for most patients are hot flashes, especially when they disturb sleep. We have effective medicines to help control this. The one I like to use is called venlafaxine, or Effexor. This medicine is an antidepressant, but the doses used for hot flash suppression are much lower than the doses used for depression. For example, the dose we start out with is 25 milligrams when treating hot flashes and over 200 milligrams when treating depression. There was a large study presented at our meeting several years ago that showed that even a tiny dose of Effexor can reduce hot flashes by two-thirds in the first week. While Effexor is a very popular medicine for this side effect of menopause, other antidepressants can help reduce hot flash too, such as Prozac and Paxil. Gabapentin, which is from another family of drugs, has also been shown to be effective in reducing hot flashes, so there are several options. I always worry when someone has hot flashes that awake them from sleep repeatedly at night. I think it is very difficult to function normally during the day when normal sleep is being interrupted during the night. Another unwelcome side effect of chemotherapy-induced menopause can be vaginal dryness. If severe, sometimes vaginal dryness can even cause a problem urinating. There are a number of things that can be done for this problem, and this can include Replenz and Astroglide, which are vaginal lubricants. Although these may help some people, I find most patients get the best relief from vaginal estrogen. Vaginal estrogen appears to be safe even in women who have hormone receptor positive tumors. It seems that when it is used in the vaginal area alone, it is not absorbed into the body. There are two ways to administer it, either through a vaginal suppository several times a week or with something called an estring. An estring is a ring that is placed in the vagina that lasts for about 3 months. Most of my patients prefer this method of vaginal estrogen. Some drugs we use can affect the heart. Luckily, this is not that common. If you're going to receive drugs such as doxorubicin, which is known as Adriamycin, or trastuzumab, you'll most likely have tests to assess how well your heart works. These tests usually done are called an echocardiogram or a MUGA scan. They give the same information. Doxorubicin or Adriamycin can damage the heart in about 1% of patients who have a normal heart function before the chemotherapy. Usually, if your heart is not perfect, we will come up with an alternative treatment regimen that does not include doxorubicin because we're not looking to cause a long-term problem. When chemotherapy is given around the time of Herceptin, which is an antibody that neutralizes HER2-new, it can also cause a pumping function with the heart. Reports vary, but up to 3.2% of patients who receive trastuzumab or Herceptin at some point after doxorubicin can have some pumping issues with the heart. Because of this, a major trend in the field is to find doxorubicin substitutes. The reason why we care so much about doxorubicin is that it is still one of the best drugs for breast cancer. So let's move on to some of the side effects of hormone therapies. Hormonal therapies have a bunch of potential long-term complications. I think the aromatase inhibitors, which are drugs like Arimidex, Femara, or Aromacin, are notorious for causing achy bones and joints. In fact, there's probably a significant percentage of women who stop taking their medications because they cannot live with the achiness caused by the drugs. And it's important is if you have a problem taking these medicines that you at least talk with your healthcare providers, because there are a lot of strategies out there that at least can be tried in order to reduce some of these side effects. A silent side effect of the aromatase inhibitors is that it can accelerate bone mineral density loss. That means the bones get weaker. Luckily, there's been a lot of attention to this, and it seems that if you have normal bone density to begin with, only 15% of women treated with an aromatase inhibitor will get osteoporosis. Tamoxifen is a very good hormonal drug for breast cancer, too. And depending on whether the taker is pre- or postmenopausal, the side effects are different. So what is the follow-up for someone who has been diagnosed with breast cancer and is done with their treatment? Doctors use guidelines to help them decide how to best treat patients to follow. Guidelines are not rules, and it is ultimately up to your doctor's discretion to recommend specific follow-up based on your individual situation. Currently, the American Society recommends that the following measures, follow-up for patients with breast cancer, and that includes a history and a physical exam, and a mammography, obviously, as the cornerstone of appropriate follow-up for breast cancer. Other tests can be ordered, such on an as-needed basis. Examinations should be performed every 3 to 6 months for the first 3 years, every 6 to 12 months, for years 4 and 5, and annually thereafter. Patients at high risk for familial breast cancer syndrome should be referred for genetic counseling. So weight is a big issue for patients who've undergone breast cancer chemotherapy. And it's very interesting because one of the things that we know is that the higher the body mass index, which is a nice way of saying how much extra weight you carry, can lead to increased risk of relapse and death from breast cancer. So that's why we pay a lot of attention to weight issues in patients who have undergone treatment for breast cancer. In general, in the general population, most women tend to gain weight from age 55 up to about age 55, and then they begin to stabilize and then lose weight. In breast cancer, there was a very interesting study that looked at pre-chemotherapy weight following and then weight change following a breast cancer diagnosis. And in that study, there were over 3,000 women who were followed. And basically what they found was that chemotherapy was significantly associated with an increase in weight, but tamoxifen was not. And only 10% of patients returned to their pre-cancer weight after diagnosis and follow-up visits. So this is something that we really need to be careful about. Well, I could certainly talk for hours and hours about all these topics, but we have other wonderful speakers to talk, so I think I will conclude there and then take your questions at the end of the program. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Vadas, for a very comprehensive presentation on breast cancer and really covering all these different topics in a really an encyclopedic manner. So thank you very much for really setting this context for us. Our next speaker is Dr. Cheryl Rock. And Dr. Rock is Professor of Family and Preventive Medicine, Cancer Prevention and Control Program, University of California, San Diego. And Dr. Rock is going to cover some nutrition guidelines for you all to be aware of, and I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Rock.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and it really is a pleasure to be involved in this organization and this group and this event. It's great that so many of you want to keep well-educated and take charge of your health at this point in your life. I can segue very nicely by saying that, as Dr. Vadas was just talking about, weight is a big issue. And as I summarize in my next few minutes to talk about nutrition and diet issues in breast cancer and breast cancer survivors, the number one most important issue is that for a woman diagnosed with breast cancer, achieving or maintaining a desirable weight is really the most important lifestyle pursuit. And how that can be achieved with diet is basically by reducing caloric intake relative to expenditure. There are a lot of popular diets that come and go about eating more fat or less fat, but in general, what we know from literally decades of nutritional science is that it comes down to calories. There is one very useful strategy for reducing calories and still feeling content, and that is to increase the amount of low-calorie low-energy density foods like vegetables and fruits. The more of those foods that are on your plate, the more they'll fill up your stomach, and then the less of the other higher-calorie foods you'll feel like you need to eat. It's a nice way to avoid deprivation when you're trying to eat less calories. So rather than say, I won't eat this and I won't eat that, the first step for maintaining a good caloric intake would be to eat more vegetables. Don't limit them. Fill your plate. Have vegetables for snacks. Add vegetables to whatever else you're eating. Add fruit, too. For example, adding fruit to cereal and salads will also help fill you up and give you a lot of good essential nutrients and then make it easier to eat less calories. The next guideline that's really part of that is to increase physical activity, which you'll hear more about in a few minutes. That's the other part of the equation of energy balance and promoting weight control. And that's crucially important for breast cancer survivors in particular for achieving a normally healthy metabolism and avoiding excessive weight gain and promoting weight loss. In terms of diet composition, the first general recommendation is that the foods you eat should be the things that are rich in nutrients and would allow you to meet all your nutritional needs before, during, and after initial treatments for breast cancer, and to stay in good health while you continue in survivorship. What is a healthy diet? Well, the first part of a healthy diet is to eat at least 5 servings a day of vegetables and fruits. I think everybody's heard that, and sometimes it sounds overwhelming, but if you understand that a serving is generally about a half cup of chopped vegetables or fruit, so that in having a meal with a large salad, you may take care of 3 servings right there. It's also better to emphasize things like fruits and vegetables, whole fruits and vegetables rather than juices, because juice can be relatively calorically dense. And studies haven't really shown that there's a particular benefit by having juices, including vegetable juice, if you have adequate amounts of more commonly consumed vegetables and fruits. Also, a good guide for which ones are the best choices are the ones that are more colorful. They tend to have more active biological ingredients that may help when reducing risk for cancer recurrence. And even more important than that, they're associated with reducing the risk for other kinds of diseases, like heart disease, which does remain the major cause of death for women in the United States, and diabetes and other kinds of chronic health problems that can be present in the survivorship years. Another good recommendation is to choose whole grains in preference to processed or refined cereal grain products. Whole grains are also, like fruits and vegetables, a very good source of a lot of other biologically active ingredients, not just vitamins and minerals, but a lot of other things that seem to be linked to better health and lower risk for health problems as you continue in your life. Processed and red meats should be minimal in your diet, mainly because they are associated with greater risk for problems with other health problems developing. They're typically higher in saturated fat, which is the type of fat that really all Americans should get less than 7% of their total calories from saturated fat. There are some studies that are still being explored that have suggested that breast cancer survivors in particular may benefit by eating less fat. But part of that message is that the types of fats may be even more important than the total amount of fat in your diet, that monounsaturated fats like we get from plant foods like avocados or nuts or canola oil or olive oil, those are not the ones that seem to pose the biggest health risk. And they also tend to be good sources of other micronutrients and phytochemicals in the diet that may be helpful. In terms of whether or not you should take dietary supplements, the studies to date haven't shown that taking dietary supplements is particularly beneficial. They certainly don't take the place of having a good overall diet. And in terms of health risk, because it's possible to get excessively high amounts of vitamins and minerals and unknown ingredients that may have been derived from food, there's a certain health risk involved in taking dietary supplements. It's certainly something that you should talk to your doctor about because there are some drug-nutrient interactions that can happen with some of the more common supplements that people take. Last but not least, it's worth mentioning that with alcohol, what we know in terms of alcohol's effect in the diet is that in some people, at least, it seems to be tolerated at low doses, for women, 1 drink a day on average. seems to be associated with minimal effects on risk and some possible effects of improving risk for cardiovascular disease. But this really has to be decided on an individual basis. It's another thing to talk about with your physician. What is my personal health risk? And that could influence your personal decision about alcohol. Another interesting thing about the alcohol connection is that there are now several studies that have suggested that the amount of the B vitamin folate in your diet may actually dampen a bit of the adverse effect of alcohol on breast cancer risk. So again, it gets back to my first point, and that is to make sure that you're eating plenty of vegetables and fruits and the protective foods, and that may enable you to have a small amount of those foods that we know maybe aren't so nutritious, but they make life a little bit more fun. It's looking at your overall diet, which is very helpful. And if you want more information, it's not a bad idea to ask for a referral to a registered dietitian, because that person can help individualize your personal goals and develop menu plans and things that would work into your normal busy life, and certainly during treatment that can be very helpful. So I'll turn it back over to Carolyn at this point.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rock, for an excellent presentation. Very informative and actually really helpful in terms of really tips for people. And I think I just want to really echo again your concept of really people being referred to a registered dietitian for follow-up individualized care around their own nutrition guidelines. So thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Silver. Dr. Silver is Assistant Professor, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Silver is going to focus on exercise guidelines for everybody. Dr. Silver?
Carolyn, thank you. I'm delighted to be here talking to all of you because exercise is such an important topic. And while we all know a lot about it and have heard and read much about exercise, in fact, we almost know too much, and it becomes very confusing. So in the short time that I have, I want to really distill what's important for breast cancer survivors to know about exercise. Let me start with definitions. There are five different types of exercise. First is cardiovascular or aerobic. Second is strength training. Third is flexibility. Fourth is sport-specific, and that would be like you're an athlete and you're trying to become a better basketball player, and so you're shooting baskets or something like that. Fifth is functional, and that's maybe if you had a stroke and you're working on balance and coordination and gait. Of those five types of exercise, two are really important for breast cancer survivors, and that's cardiovascular and strength training. There are instances when flexibility exercises are important, such as if a woman is having, a woman or a man, is having problems moving their shoulder after surgery. Range of motion and flexibility exercises become very important. However, people often spend far too much time on stretching and not enough time on strength training and cardiovascular exercise. And strength training and cardiovascular exercise are the ones that really matter. Those are the ones that will help you heal, develop lean body mass, which is great for you, and really get you feeling better, stronger, healthier. So that's what people need to concentrate on. Unfortunately, guidelines tend to really be for active, healthy people. And there aren't great guidelines for people who've been through breast cancer treatment in terms of what they should really be doing when and what's safe. We're developing those more and more in terms of looking at research studies and things. For instance, the idea of strength training in people who have had an axillary dissection and may develop lymphedema has been something that's been really looked at, trying to decide should we be recommending strength training for people who have had an axillary dissection and will they develop lymphedema if we do. The answer seems to be that strength training is okay and, in fact, helpful. Certainly there are people who will develop lymphedema, but strength training doesn't seem to promote it. In fact, it seems to overall be very healthy for people to participate in, as long as it's done in an appropriate manner. So what's appropriate? That's a great question. What's appropriate for breast cancer survivors? What I tell my patients, and what I think is a really great thing to do, is just to start out with the cardio, because that's the easiest piece. And before you even start to exercise, get a pedometer, put it on your belt, and track how many steps a day you take. For active, healthy adults, the recommendation is 10,000 steps a day. Most breast cancer survivors, especially if they've recently been through treatment, will be way under that. So my first recommendation isn't even about exercise. It's just about tracking what you're doing and seeing how far you need to go. Trying to set goals that are appropriate. It's appropriate to set a goal of, say, 500, to increase the amount of time you're walking by 500 steps a day every 2 to 4 weeks. At some point, you'll definitely want to check in with your doctor, with your oncologist, but in the beginning, all you're doing is tracking your activity that you're already doing. So your doctor doesn't even need to be involved initially because of course, your doctor's not going to tell you not to do what you're already doing, unless you're very active and sort of too active. But this is just tracking the number of steps and how you're getting around. So begin with tracking your steps. Increase by 500 steps per day every 2 to 4 weeks if you can tolerate that. Check in with your doctor sort of early in this process so that you are sure that your heart is capable of doing this and increasing to the 10,000 steps a day. Then consider adding on the strength training. Strength training means some kind of resistance so that you're lifting something or pulling something or stretching something. And in terms of strength training, most people who haven't done strength training in the past will need a little bit of expert guidance. Maybe a session or two with a physical therapist would be a good idea. Your doctor can certainly arrange that. What I find in my practice, and this is very anecdotal but it's important to note, is that when I see patients who have suddenly developed lymphedema because of a strength training kind of thing or a lifting kind of thing, it's often because they've done some sort of household chore and they've lifted a huge amount very quickly without proper preparation. So, for example, I have a woman in my practice who couldn't wait for her husband to come home. She wanted to get the Poland Springs water up and flowing, so she lifted this huge jug of Poland Springs water, and right after that she did develop lymphedema. That kind of lifting is something to really be wary of and to not do. Those very heavy lifts that occur quite suddenly. But I wouldn't want people to be afraid of gentle strength training, especially under the guidance of an expert, because it's really great for you. So as you're thinking of exercise, think about using a pedometer, seeing how active you actually are and where you need to be. The goal would be 10,000 steps a day. Then you can start doing a little bit of cross training, which would mean adding in some different kinds of exercise, like maybe you want to cycle or swim or do other things. And then add a little bit of strength training in as well. Those are the things that are really important. If you're having problems with your shoulder, absolutely some flexibility. And often this will be, again, with an expert such as a physical therapist who will help guide that. That's really how to exercise in a nutshell, and I hope that's helpful.
That's incredibly helpful. Dr. Silver, I want to thank you very much, and I know there'll be probably questions for you during the Q&A, but this is incredibly helpful and very interesting information for everybody to keep track of, and the way you organized it was very, very interesting, so thank you. Our next speaker is Patricia Spicer. Pat Spicer is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. She is the Breast Cancer Program Coordinator for Cancer Care, and Pat Spicer is going to talk about body image and intimacy and the importance of a support network. I'm going to turn the program over to Pat.
Thank you, Carolyn. I think this conference is particularly exciting because we are beginning to look at the issues that remain for women who have completed treatment, so I'm thrilled to have this opportunity. Within the last several years, we've seen a steady increase in survivorship for breast cancer patients, and this in turn has led us to a whole new set of issues for women as they try to make the adjustment from patient mode to wellness mode. It takes time and it takes effort to cope with a diagnosis and treatment and to deal with the emotional issues associated with treatment side effects, changes in body image, role changes at home and at work, and friends and family are often there to help and support. The healthcare team has offered a sense of safety as they monitored your physical condition. However, once treatment is finished, as Dr. Vedant indicated, doctor appointments are spaced farther apart. Friends and family feel a sense of relief that it's all over, and the expectation is that it is all over for you, and life and you will go back to what normal was before your diagnosis. This isn't always so easy to do, and one of the most discussed issues in the post-treatment group has been the changes that the experience of cancer has made in the way women view their lives and often how their priorities have changed. Many women view their recovery as a second chance and have discovered strength through treatment that they did not know they had. Others have reexamined their relationships with friends and family and have chosen to reorient their work goals to have more time to focus on their lives. Some women have even chosen to begin new careers or to set boundaries on the demands made by family or friends. As one woman in the group put it, "I'm tired of being a super mom. I just want to be woman." Another issue that frequently arises is the physical changes that have taken place. We learned about the possibilities of lymphedema today, the possibilities that mastectomy have changed your feeling about your body, about the effect of vaginal dryness due to lowering of hormonal levels, and all this can have a profound effect on a woman's ability to enjoy intimacy with their partners. It leaves them with a concern that their femininity has been diminished, and it's often difficult for partners to understand that they are not being rejected, but rather that this is an uncertainty that the woman has yet to resolve. Open communication at this point is a very important event in recovery from breast cancer and in reestablishing a physical relationship. Talking to your partner about whether how you feel about it, what is pleasurable for you and what isn't, is a very often a good way to begin a dialogue and to let them know that if you are less than enthusiastic at all times, it simply means that sometimes you're tired, you haven't recovered yet completely from chemotherapy, or that you are concerned about how your body looks and what his reaction is going to be to it. Partners also express concern about whether it's safe to touch a woman, whether it will make her uncomfortable. And one man just put it so succinctly, he said, "I don't know who this person is anymore, and I love her, but I can't be sure that she loves me back." So you have to be careful about opening up dialogue with your partner and addressing the physical changes in your body with him. It's also difficult for family to understand that sometimes you're not going to be as energetic as you were before. Women talk about the difference in their energy levels, and the discussion is very often around, "My family expects me to do all the things I did before, and I can't anymore, nor do I want to." But perhaps the most pressing concern that is expressed in the group is the fear of recurrence, so that many women find it easier to look for a healthier lifestyle, as we've talked about today, to reduce the stress in their lives how it affects them, and it still remains one of the most foremost concerns. There are many positives that grow out of the cancer experience that women have delineated, and these include the opportunity to discover more about yourself, a deeper enjoyment of life, an ability to be in the moment and to learn what is really important. The cancer journey is a difficult one, and it's not over for many women with the completion of treatment. And at Cancer Care, we want to continue to offer support. We have online telephone groups and individual counseling for women in the post-treatment phase. So please feel free to contact us at www.cancercare.org or at 1-800-813-4673. And above all, be very kind to yourselves. Give yourselves time to become the well person that you were before your treatment. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, for that just wonderful presentation and really, again, for the concept of really each person on this call really being kind to themselves. Thank you so much. Excellent presentation. And okay, well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our speakers for really doing such a phenomenal job. I want to thank each of you. This has really been outstanding, and it's a wonderful chance for us to present a number of different topics for all of you on the call. I want to thank all of you who also have queued up and asked such wonderful questions. Clearly, your questions, we hope the answers were helpful to you, but your questions really enhanced the call today. And I also want to thank all of you who have been listening to the call and who probably have questions that you may want to ask after the call. Now, I want to remind you this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so, again, I just want to remind you about all the services that you can access for free from Cancer Care, from our professionally trained master's-level oncology social workers. We have 40 of them here. And we're here to provide you with practical and financial assistance, with counseling services, both a chance to talk with a social worker or to participate in a telephone or online support group. We also offer you a chance just to talk about issues or concerns that you may be coping with. We have lots of informational materials, and, of course, we run lots of telephone education workshops as well. So with all that being said, there's lots of different things here that we have, and we want you to really be aware of them. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I wouldn't want you to feel that you're alone with any of your concerns or your questions or problems. You're now part of the community of support from Cancer Care, which means you can call us at any time, and we're here to provide you with help. And I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.